Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. And Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world's history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it, and I know it. Now, there isn't one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Now, the business of a journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes, he said. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program. It's the New World Order, men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. Let's wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and to stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and to survive this New World Order, this Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's the place to start. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. And again, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Supreme Court, the third branch of government. It's commonly called the junior branch of government. It's a check and balance on the other two. And as we've seen, there's two divergent views that evolved early on in our republic's history as to what the role of the Supreme Court ought to be. First, Jefferson's view that each branch of government would determine the constitutionality or the Constitution as it relates to that branch. And the second opinion was John Marshall, the second Chief Justice, who thought that the Supreme Court should be the check and balance on the other two branches of government. Now, the treatise that we're covering here is called The Supreme Court, put out by Foundations of Liberty. And Foundations of Liberty is published by the East Moline Christian School, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. The editor is James R. Patrick. Phone number is 309-796-1485. Now, let me run that by you one more time. The phone is 309-796-1485. And it's called Foundations of Liberty. That's the name of the publication. It's put out twice a month. This one is titled The Supreme Court. Their address is 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, and their zip code is 61244. Now, the article that we're covering here is written by Joe Ferguson, who was a former congressman from Utah. And he pointed out that there were a number of factors that should be considered here in this concept of legitimate federal powers. What are these legitimate federal powers, and then what are the illegitimate federal powers? And he pointed out in the last program here, what is constitutional, what is unconstitutional, and what is anti-constitutional. Now, the original understanding of the Constitution versus what we see now as judicial activism, let's take a look at it. When most of us think of constitutional law, and we think of law that is in harmony with and has its roots in our Constitution. Now, this rationale is correct, and it's called the philosophy of original intent, the original understanding. It's as basic and sound as saying that 2 plus 2 equals 4. It means that a judge, when considering a case involving constitutional issues, refers to the Constitution itself for his authority. This is recognized procedure in all forms of law. When we examine a will, the judge refers to the wording of the will and, if necessary, the intent of the will maker. If he's looking at a statute, he looks at the wording of the statute and the intent of its drafters. Now, this logic should be applied in all areas of law. It is, except for one area, and that's in the area of the Constitution. In the area of the Constitution, there has never been a legitimate lawful jurisdiction for departing from original understanding. Various theories of interpretation of the Constitution have been advanced. However, they have sprouted like noxious weeds, which guides the interpreter, or the judge in this case, to refer to anything and everything except the Constitution as his final authority. Now, these theories are obviously the product of those in the legal field whose ideologies and biases make it too painful for them to hold the Constitution as the final, or for that matter, any authority whatsoever. Judicial neutrality means that when applying the law, the responsibility of a judge is to disregard his own political or personal biases and then apply the law. In cases involving the Constitution, it means to hold the Constitution as the final authority. When a judge departs from the Constitution, he is creating new law. He is, in fact, legislating, and this is referred to as judicial activism, as opposed to judicial neutrality, or revisionism. The theories advocating revisionism, that is, the act of revising the law, are, it seems, endless. And they range from the idea that we should not conform to the Constitution because it was written so long ago and we cannot understand it. Kind of like the Ten Commandments, perhaps. It's been written so long ago we can't understand, thou shalt not steal or thou shalt not kill. It is to the idea that living should not be ruled by the dead and all those who wrote the Constitution are dead. One example of this type of thinking comes from the noted legal academic Dean Paul Brust of Stanford University. He said, what authority does the written Constitution have in our system of constitutional government? This is not an empty question, although Article 6 declares that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. A document cannot achieve the status of law, let alone supreme law, merely by its own assertion. I don't know why not, but this is the dean of the law school there at Stanford. He says that that Constitution cannot assume that role of supreme law of the land just because it says it's the supreme law of the land. I guess you and I should ask, well, then what is the supreme law of the land? Well, according to the political theory most deeply rooted in the American tradition, the authority of the Constitution derives from the consent of its adopters. Even if the adopters freely consented to the Constitution, however, this is not an adequate basis for continuing fidelity to the founding document because their consent cannot bind succeeding generations. We did not adopt the Constitution, and those who did are dead and gone. Now, that quotation comes from Paul Brest, The Misconceived Quest for the Original Understanding. It was quoted in Robert H. Bork, The Tempting of America, The Political Seduction of the Law, page 172. Now, as ridiculous, as ludicrous, as asinine, fatuitous, and illogical that Brest's position might be, it is indicative of the attitudes of many in the various areas of the legal field today. And Judge Bork comments on these revisionist, anti-constitutionalist theories. He said, to read the literature is to have one's worst fears confirmed. The sense that something in constitutional theory has gone high begins with the style of argumentation. The older constitutional commentators, secure in their common sense lawyer's view of the Constitution, wrote prose that remains clear, to the point, self-confident, and accessible to the non-professional reader. The modern theorists, however, are different. Their concepts are abstruse, their sources philosophical, their arguments convoluted, their prose necessarily complex. These writers are, in fact, undertaking what Justice Story forswore. The alteration of the Constitution by ingenious subtleties, metaphysical refinements, and visionary speculation to make it not a document addressed to the common sense of the people, but one addressed to a specialized and sophisticated clerisy of judicial power. Now, the theory of original understanding requires the meticulous adherence to established legal procedures, observing the equal rights and authorities of the people, their legislators, and their elected executives, and established judicial restraint to the contrary. Judicial activism and revisionism leaves the determination of vital issues and the fate of the nation and its inhabitants to the whims, biases, and prejudices of nine lawyers as absolute and final authority, leaving the people with no recourse. The values of revisionist judge enforces obviously do not come from the law. If they did, we would not be revising. When a judge indulges in revisionism, he is displaying the extreme form of civil disobedience. He is rebelling against the democratically established system of American law. Of the many revisionist theories, none conform to legitimate American law. All are hostile to it. And Judge Bork put it very concisely when he said, in truth, Only the approach of original understanding meets the criteria that any theory of constitutional adjudication must meet in order to possess democratic legitimacy. Only that approach is consistent and consonant with the design of the American Republic. Judicial activism and revisionism are nothing more than sophisticated stratagems employed by the Supreme Court to deviate from the Constitution as the supreme law and instead rule by whatever deviant logic or authority they wish to apply in the particular case at hand. This process has been going on now for decades, and the damage that has been done is extensive. And Judge Bork explains the effect that this has on our political system. And he said, what is worrisome is that so many of the court's increased number of declarations of unconstitutionality are not even plausibly related to the actual Constitution itself. This means that we are increasingly governed not by law or elected representatives, but by an unelected, unrepresented, unaccountable committee of lawyers applying no will but their own. The power of the Supreme Court is awesome, and it is not surprising that there are those forces in the body politic which would strive to influence the court to abandon the law and rule to satisfy their own political objectives. To think otherwise would be naive to the extreme. Now, the politicization of the court has occurred, past it. The court has now taken on a political aspect. All theories of judicial activism and revisionism have this one thing in common. They produce stratagems and justification to deviate from the Constitution. And while at the same time contradicting each other, they have collectively served one definite purpose, to subvert the Supreme Court from a politically neutral body to a power base of political activists whose ideologies are hostile to the Constitution and objectives contrary to that of the majority of Americans. In the clash of law and politics, the integrity of the law has already been seriously undermined, and the quality of its future remains very much in doubt. The forces that would break law to a tame instrument of particular political thrust are past midway in a long march through our institutions. They have overrun a number of law schools, including a large majority of America's most prestigious, where the lawyers and judges of the future are being trained. They have an increasing voice in our politics and in Congress. But the focus of the struggle, the commanding heights sought to be taken, as indeed it partially has been, is control of the courts and the Constitution. The Constitution, or the law we call constitutional, they are by no means identical, is the highest prize, and control of the selection of judges is the last step on the path to that prize. And why is that? It's because the Constitution is the trump card in American politics, and judges decide what the Constitution means. So when the Supreme Court invokes the Constitution, whether legitimately or illegitimately, as to the issue, the democratic process is at the end. Now, Judge Bork continues to explain that those who would use the courts to their own political advantage hold to ideologies that are hostile to the Constitution and anathema to Americanism. And that's why they constantly strive to induce the courts to make end runs around the Constitution in order to reach their desired political objectives. Now, the orthodoxy of original understanding and the political neutrality of judging it requires our anathema to liberal culture that for 50 years has won a succession of political victories from the courts and that hopes for more political victories in the future. The representatives of that culture hate the American orthodoxy because they have moral and political agendas of their own that cannot be found in the Constitution and that no legislature, or at least none whose members wish to be reelected, will enact. And that is why these partisans want judges who will win their victories for them by altering the Constitution. The Supreme Court, it can be conclusively demonstrated, is no longer politically neutral. It has become extremely politicized. The best that might be said of the court of today is that it is not as much of a rogue as the court of Earl Warren, yet it remains politicized, and it has by no means returned to the Constitution as its foundation of authority. So let's take a look at the Supreme Court versus the Constitution. In the discussion of original understanding versus judicial activism and revisionism, we considered samples of the attitudes of some of the influential in the legal field. The Supreme Court, which originally adhered reasonably closely to its responsibility of holding the Constitution to be the supreme law of the land, has gone through a metamorphosis over the past several decades and is now an entirely different creature from what it was intended to be, from what it is supposed to be, and what it professes to be. What change has been wrought? Is the Supreme Court no longer the guardian of the Constitution and of our liberties? The very question shocks some. Those appointed to the Supreme Court are presumably among our nation's finest legal minds and occupy positions of the highest honor and respect. Why should their performance even be questioned? If there is any validity to Lord Acton's dictum, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, The Supreme Court is one body whose performance should be under constant scrutiny. The power of the Supreme Court is as final and absolute as any power in our government. Originally intended to be restrained by judging the law, the Supreme Court has taken upon itself the power to not only legislate, but to amend the applied meaning of the Constitution. If a violation of the Constitution is a valid means by which to judge, then the Supreme Court might be proven to be the most corrupt branch of our government today. The matter can be easily resolved by an examination of its product, and that is, its rulings. As Jesus said, you will know them by their fruits. Honestly reviewed, a ruling of the Supreme Court reveals, usually, very clearly, whether its judges have conformed to the supreme law which they are bound by oath to uphold. Such a review looks past the prestige that he honors, the status, the degrees, the robes, and above all, the pernicious presumptions that judges can do no wrong and that the Constitution is whatever they wish to say it is at any given moment in time. In one case, Butler versus Beecrab might be a good place to start for three good reasons. The first is that it was adjudicated in 1936, so the actors are no longer extant. The absence of personalities perhaps will aid in objectivity. The second is that it bears directly on our central question of the legitimate authority of the federal government. The third is that it was an abrupt reversal from previous judgments on the same issue, a departure from the Constitution, and established the precedent for subsequent similar rulings to radically change the course of our government. Now, the time was during the Depression, a time of distress. President Franklin Roosevelt was attempting to launch his New Deal programs, ostensibly to get the economy moving again. The issue in the case was the constitutionality of an act of Congress. And until the 1930s, the courts generally held to the concept of limited government as expressed in Proposition A that we began our discussion with. Well, in 1936, in the Butler case, the Supreme Court abruptly changed the course of the entire federal government. That is explained thus. Finally, in 1936, the Supreme Court gave its unqualified endorsement to Hamilton's views on the taxing power. Justice Roberts wrote the opinion to settle once and for all whether the Jefferson-Madison interpretation or the Hamilton theory should prevail. And he stated that Madison asserted it, the welfare clause, amounted to no more than a reference to the other powers enumerated in the subsequent clauses of the same section, talking about the health, education, and welfare of the nation now. That is, that the United States is a government of limited and enumerated powers. The grant of power to tax and spend for the general national welfare must be confined to the enumerated legislative fields committed to Congress. Hamilton, on the other hand, maintained that the clause confers a power separate and distinct from those later enumerated. And that is not restricted from those later enumerated, is not restricted in meaning by the grant of them, and Congress subsequently has a substantive power to tax and to appropriate, limited only by the requirement that it shall be exercised to provide for the general welfare of the United States. While, therefore, the power to tax is not unlimited, its confines are set in the clause which confers it, and not in those of Section 8, which bestow the definite legislative powers of Congress. Now, this obvious contradiction in the concluding sentence defies a rational explanation. The court admitted that this section defines the enumerated powers to which the Congress is restricted, and then turns around and uses the words general welfare to justify legislating in any field, even though it is not enumerated. Now, this decision alone was sufficient to literally destroy the whole concept of limited government. So if you want to know where limited government went astray, it was in the Butler decision 1936, as it relates to the question of the welfare of the public. Exactly as Jefferson and Madison had predicted, it came to pass. Justice Roberts wanted to be sure that there would be no further ground for argument in favor of the Jefferson-Madison view, and therefore stated as a positive judicial mandate that the General Welfare Clause allows Congress to authorize expenditure of public monies for public purposes and is not limited by the direct grants of legislative power found in the Constitution. The only concession the court would make was the fact that the Tenth Amendment would prevent the Congress from invading areas reserved to the states. This modest reservation lasted barely a year when the court overruled itself in the Social Security Act cases. This is cited from W. Cleon Scouse in The Making of America, page 388. Now, in order for the court to make the above decision, it relied solely for authority upon the words of one man, Hamilton. It is most important that the words upon which the court relied were those of Hamilton, after he had become Secretary of the Treasury and wanted to achieve some political objective which would have necessitated the changing of the intent of the welfare clause of the Constitution. The position that he took at that time was the exact opposite of his position when he was a delegate at the convention. According to correct law, his words, as stated during the ratification process, should have been given weight, but his words subsequent to the ratification should have been given none. Now, it is much to Hamilton's discredit that he made this change in his position in order to achieve a political ambition, and much to the discredit of the court of 1836, or 1936, rather, that it ignored Hamilton's original position as well as many clearly written and most important provisions in our Constitution. These will be explained in the concluding chapter. I've got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. We are reviewing the Supreme Court put out by a publication called Foundations of Liberty. Subject matter is the Supreme Court. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number to call 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic. Partisans in their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing the Supreme Court. It's the lead article of the Foundations of Liberty publication, which is put out by the East Moline Christian School. It's called Foundations of Liberty. If you want a copy, write to the East Moline Christian School, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. James R. Patrick is the editor. Phone number up there is 309-796-1485. Again, that's area code 309-796-1485. All right, we're talking about the Supreme Court. Now, the Butler case back in 1936, there's a statement in the Constitution that deals with welfare. But it's the welfare of the nation. It's not the welfare of the individuals who are getting on the welfare program. And in 1936, the Roosevelt administration wanted to bring relief at taxpayer expense to those people who, in their judgment, needed welfare payments, such as Social Security, aid to families with dependent children, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, the kinds of social programs extant in many countries in the world, especially socialist countries, back in the 1920s and 30s. Now, the Roosevelt administration adopted communism as the model by which they would introduce these concepts into America. In order to do that, they had to bypass our Constitution. Now, remember, our federal Constitution is a grant of powers, and anything that is not granted by the Constitution is not legitimate federal territory. So let's take a look at a few items here for funsies. Let's take education, for example. The federal government is very engaged in the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto by taxing and spending and legislating in the area of public schools. And there's no mandate from the Constitution. There is nothing in the Constitution that provides any role for federal government or federal government expenditures in public education. And yet they're involved in it right up to their eyeballs. Welfare, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, Social Security, all of these New Deal programs were extra constitutional, had nothing to do with our Constitution. Now, the people of America have decided that they want their government involved in their economy. Well, okay, it is, has been, and is going to continue to be. Whether that's good for the general welfare of the nation has been demonstrated in the last depression of the 1930s when it was a total failure. And Henry Morgenthau, who was Secretary of the Treasury, testified in 1939 before Congress and said that everything, every plan, every program that they put in place from 1933 to 39 had failed, past tense. Now, that's not what they teach in public school, and that's not what I learned when I went to public school, that all of these programs succeeded beyond their wildest expectations, and the solution to the Great Depression was the New Deal. Okay, so that's what we're going to follow in this current depression. And when that happens, in contradistinction to 1922, when the depression lasted for 1 year and was over, the depression of 1929 lasted for 10 or 11 years and was finally terminated by the entry of America into World War II. This depression, I think, will follow the same pattern that we saw in the 1930s. In other words, if we do the same stunts that we did in the 1930s, we should get the same result. We should have a 10 or 11 year depression. And all of the programs that are assigned to solve the problem, and they're going to cost a lot of money, they will bankrupt the nation, bring us hyperinflation, and a 10 or 11 year depression. That's what happened the last time, and that's what should happen this time. Now, last time we had sound money. This time our money is no longer sound, and it's going to collapse. How do I know that? Because that's what happened in Germany in 1923. When we do what the Germans did in 1919, 1920, 21, 22, we should get the same result that they got in 1923. I think it's a bad result, but then I'm not here to tell you how to vote and tell you what my view is or what we should do. I'm not here to influence you to tell you that. I'm here as a reporter to tell you that it didn't work the last time. There's not much hope that it's going to work this time. Now, I'll let you be the judge. The Butler case was a flagrant, arrogant example of judicial activism on the part of the Supreme Court. Now, it was 1936. This case established the precedent which unleashed a torrent of anti-constitutional rulings which continue to this day. The court rarely, if ever, corrects departures from the Constitution of former courts. It gives more validity to case law than it does to the Constitution. And that is, when an issue before the court involving the Constitution, it refers not to the Constitution itself, but to a prior ruling of an earlier court. It is true that the following of precedent, when based upon sound law, is necessary for order in our legal system, but when a departure from the supreme law is evident, it is the responsibility of the court to hold to the Constitution rather than erroneous rulings. Judges do not take oaths to uphold case law. Their oaths are to uphold the Constitution. And it is obvious that when the court departs, or when it depends upon a flawed ruling and then ignores the Constitution, the intent of that court is as egregious as that of the prior court. And it can be observed that in all of its meandering around in the law, the Supreme Court is disposed to go any direction except in the direction of the Constitution. Now, to address questions that might have been raised by the heading of this chapter, the Supreme Court versus the Constitution, the indictment that the Supreme Court might be opposed to the Constitution, when each justice then sits thereon, has given his or her solemn oath to uphold and defend the same, might startle some and enrage others. But the facts justify the indictment, and in the evaluation of an honest mind will result in a conviction. The Supreme Court, originally intended to be politically neutral, has now become politically very powerful, and certainly the least restrained of the three branches of government. In the process, it has evolved to be the most voracious and vicious enemy of the Constitution, to Americanism, and to the stability of our legal system, and to the future security of our republic. It has turned our legal system upside down and inside out. Its rulings have ordered acts hostile to the Constitution, and it has denied rights to citizens guaranteed under the Constitution. Upon the theories and practices of judicial activism and revisionism, the Supreme Court has diminished, to an alarming degree, the force and effect of the Constitution, and it appears that it plans to continue along this same course until the Constitution is rendered completely impotent. If, in fact, the Supreme Court has effectively diminished and continues to diminish the force and effect of the Constitution, it is not then an enemy, or is it not then an enemy of the Constitution? Let's take a look and at another section here. We now have a central bank issuing paper money. Is that central bank issuing paper money provided for in the Constitution of the United States? The answer to that question is an unqualified, absolutely no, it is not. The Constitution provides for the money system of the United States to be made of gold and silver coin, to be regulated, or the value of it to be regulated by Congress, and to be issued by our Treasury. And for, well, about 130 years, from 1794 until about 1933, the government of the United States issued gold and silver coin, and we became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world, politically, economically, militarily. Now, in 1933, we threw that aside under House Joint Resolution 192, and we adopted the central bank policy, which was created back in 1913. And once we did away with gold in 1965, we did away with silver coin. Now we have clad coin and paper money. Now in 1930, you could take a $20 gold piece, walk into a men's store, and buy a Hickey Freeman suit with wingtip shoes, tie, suspenders, belt, shirt, and walk out with change. That's a $20 gold piece. Today, If you took that same $20 gold piece into a men's store, you could walk out with a Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, belt, suspenders, shirt. It hasn't lost any of its value. It hasn't lost any of its purchasing power. That's the $20 gold piece. Now, we substituted the $20 gold piece for a $20 bill. And in 1930, you could have walked into a men's store with a $20 Federal Reserve note. You could have bought a Hickey Freeman suit. You could have bought wingtip shoes. You could have bought a belt and suspenders and shirt and tie. But now that same $20 Federal Reserve note has depreciated in value by 98%. And what would you get in a men's store today with a $20 bill? One necktie. Now, there's a clear-cut deviation from our Constitution. It was enacted by Congress in 1913, and it has been upheld, and it has been promoted by our Supreme Court from that day to this. Now, a number of cases have been brought before the Supreme Court dealing with money and the money issue, and in every case, the Supreme Court always rules in favor of the Federal Reserve System, the central bank, and then against gold and silver. Now, Congress in 1986 reestablished our gold and silver coin, and we now have our gold and silver coin back. It's minted in West Point, New York. And we now have $50 gold pieces. They upped it to 50 from 20. That's a 1 ounce gold coin. And those 1 ounce gold coins are in circulation today. And just like the silver eagles are in circulation, they're the equivalent of a silver dollar. In fact, they're denominated as a silver dollar. Now that follows Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution. But by now, all of our people are used to using these Federal Reserve notes. All of our people now are used to using this fiat paper currency. About 5% of the people of America hold, own, and possess 100% of our gold and silver that's in circulation. Not 100% of all that was confiscated back in 1933, but all that's out here in circulation today. And 95% of the people are penniless. They have no money. They have scrip. And that follows the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. Tenth plank is public school. Second plank is a heavy progressive income tax. We used to support our federal government by impost and ex post taxes. Today we do it with the income tax. We used to tax foreigners who wanted to sell their goods in this country and made them pay the burdens of our government. And then we decided, well, that's not good for foreigners. And so now we tax ourselves to support our government. And there doesn't seem to be any limitation on the amount of taxes the government can impose. During the Roosevelt years, the maximum federal income tax hit 91%. Today, as I speak, I think it's 42 or 43%. Minimum income tax is about 17%. If you had the 17 and the Social Security tax of 16, that's a third of everything that we create and produce that's going to government. And that's only 2 out of 14 taxes. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention is that the Article 1, Section 10 clause in our Constitution is as plain as the nose on your face, and it's ignored by our courts. It's ignored by our Congress. And that's because the courts and the Congress and the executive branch of government have their own agenda, and that agenda is the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Just weights and balances mandated by the Ten Commandment model of thou shalt not steal and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, which was adopted by our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention, has now been abandoned. Now, the courts still, in my view, have more common sense working for them than does our Congress, which is bought and paid for by the lobbyists who enact whatever laws they desire. Whatever commercial laws are good for General Motors or good for Pfizer and Merck are the laws that are enacted by Congress and promoted by the executive branch of government. And if there's to be any redemption, it's going to come from our courts. It's not going to come from the legislative process. But what can you and I do to make a meaningful change? Let's take a look at logic for a moment. If gold and silver coin made America the greatest, most powerful nation in the world, and if God himself commands us to use just weights and balances, don't you think that as an individual, that's just you and me down here at the bottom of the pool, should be using gold and silver coin rather than Federal Reserve notes, checks, credit cards, mortgages, and other interest-paying pieces of paper? Just as a thought, wouldn't it be more logical, wouldn't it be in your best interest and my best interest to abandon these concepts of government that are hostile to our Constitution and hostile to your and my health, safety, and welfare? As I speak now, our president is preparing massive legislation to bring national health care insurance to every American. Can you direct me to that section of the Constitution that provides for the health, safety, and welfare of the American public by enriching the insurance industry of America by requiring that we all have health care insurance? Now, I'm not opposed to health care insurance. If people want to buy it, that's certainly their prerogative. But why should I have to pay the premiums on somebody else's health care? Somebody's going to say, well, you know, you pay your premiums and I pay my premiums, and when it's all said and done, well, then aren't we practicing from each according to his ability and to each according to his need? Why don't we leave this to the marketplace, and why don't you go out and buy your insurance if you want it, and I'll buy mine if I want it? And somebody comes along and says, yeah, but there's a bunch of people out there that can't afford it. Hell, there's a bunch of people out there that can't afford a Lamborghini. But does that mean that we should subsidize Lamborghini production for everybody in the country because they can't afford one? Have we taken total leave of our senses? There's a lot of things in life that I would like to have that I don't have the means to buy nor have the means to afford. But the fact that I can't have a Lamborghini or a Rolls Royce or a new house in Bellwood Estates doesn't mean that you ought to buy me one, does it? And I think that people that can afford Lamborghinis and new houses in Bellwood Estates certainly ought to have one. And I don't begrudge them their Lamborghinis or their Rolls Royces. But I don't want to be buying Rolls Royces, and I don't want to be buying national health care insurance for you or anybody else. In fact, I woke up some years back and said, oh, hell no, I won't go. I like that line. Now, this Butler case back in the 1930s was a flagrant, arrogant example of judicial activism on the part of the Supreme Court. And this case established the precedent, which unleashed a torrent of anti-constitutional rulings, which continue to this day. And the court rarely, if ever, corrects its departures from the constitution of any former courts. It's what we call the doctrine of stare decisis. Or as somebody corrected me, said stare decisis. Oh, okay. However you want to word it, stare decisis. What would be wrong with just looking at the Constitution and asking the question, by what authority does the Constitution grant that would provide national health care insurance at taxpayer expense? And I think that you're going to read for a long time, and I don't think you're going to find it. Now, the correct modality for putting that issue in our Constitution is through the amendment process. Why doesn't the President propose a constitutional amendment? Times have changed. We need national health care insurance. Now, let's take it to the legislatures of the states. Let's take it to the Congress of the United States, and let's pass it, and let's run it by the people of America. And if this is a good program, and it's supported by three-fourths of the people of the country, let's write it into our Constitution, make it a rule of law. And the people that are proposing this know that they can't do that because you can't get that kind of support for it. And they have a political agenda. It's communism. And in order for them to get their political agenda through, our constitutional process stands in their way. And that's why they've adopted this process. So the President, as I speak, has taken a leftist activist nominee for the Supreme Court. Nice lady, I'm sure. I wouldn't impugn that lady's credentials. She's smart. She's been an appeals court judge for 17 years. But she's an activist. She's not a strict constitutionalist. She's not going to rule in favor of the Constitution. She's going to rule. And she has made the comment, and this is what raised all the furor over here, that she thought that her judgment was better than a white man's. And it probably is. Probably. But is it from the Constitution? That's what we're hiring her for, is to construe our fundamental law of the land, not whether or not her judgment is better than the next guy. I'm sure her judgment's marvelous, probably better than mine. But if I was going to decide, I would prefer that a judge on the Supreme Court just stick with the fundamentals. Leave out paper money, leave out public education, leave out national health care insurance. Just stick strictly to the Constitution, and if, in fact, we need paper money in a national bank, or we need public education, or we need national health care insurance, let's propose three constitutional amendments. Let's put the three constitutional amendments before the people of America. And if three-fourths of them decide, yeah, that's what we want to do, and we want to tax each other to support it, let's get after it. Meanwhile, back on the farm, what we're dealing with here is communism and judicial activism and rampant, accelerated, all-powerful government. And there's a famous line that goes, government, when it becomes big enough to give you everything that you want, is now big enough to take everything that you've got. And that's the problem that our founding fathers lived through and wrote into our Constitution, a limited form of government for the express purpose of keeping the chains of the Constitution to bind that government down. Well, the chains have been broken, and the government is now out of control. That does not mean that you and I, at the personal level, that just your family and mine, can't go back to practicing that form of government mandated by the Ten Commandments, that limited government, with individual enterprise, the free enterprise system. Now, I covered that. It also came from Foundations of Liberty. It's called the Free Enterprise System. And so while you're at it, why don't you ask for that booklet called the Free Enterprise System, produced by Foundations of Liberty. Remember their address now is 900 46th Avenue in East Moline, Illinois. And then their zip code is 61244-4406. Telephone number is the same, and it's 309-796-1485. And that's 309-796-1485. Now, it's called the MacArthur Institute in this copy that I have. The Free Enterprise System, and probably a later booklet and a change in their name, the MacArthur Institute, because previously they called themselves the East Moline Christian School. Book still the same. Their publication, Foundations of Liberty, is still the same, but their their title here, the MacArthur Institute, 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. James R. Patrick, still the editor. Now, the bottom line then to this is our government now has been taken over by the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and you're not going to vote that out. And it's already well established, and it's in place, and it's firmly in place. And oftentimes, when I listen to conservatives speak, they seem to think that the salvation of America and the solution to all of our problems is to vote the bad guys out and vote the good guys in. My question is, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? Dwight D. Eisenhower, after he had nominated Earl Warren to the court, later said he regretted his nomination. How could he know that Earl Warren was an activist as opposed to a strict constructionist? He didn't. Why didn't the Congress impeach Earl Warren for his activist role? Isn't it because the Congress of the United States was made up mostly of activists themselves? So haven't you and I then elected activists in contradistinction to strict constructionists to construct our Constitution in a new form after the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto? Did we intend to do that, or is that something that has been foisted off upon us? Because if it's been foisted off upon us, then it's already done. What do you and I do to make a change? And the answer is, why don't you and I go back to practicing the Constitution? Why don't you and I get off of insurance, get off of public school? Why don't we go back to practicing the Constitution and its forms of limited government and free enterprise in our own personal life? And what you do and your neighbor does, and so on down the line, why don't you jerk your kid out of public school and educate your child at home and give him a real education instead of a socialist communist education under the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto? I think that would be a big step in the right direction. I'm out of time. I've got to give you a reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.